Angela Dawson lived in a tough area in Baltimore and refused to allow drug dealers to rule her neighborhood. Police say she called 911 dozens of times over the past year. Eventually, she became enough of a nuisance that somebody threw firebombs into her kitchen. Angela Dawson refused to be intimidated. She kept up her one-woman fight against the dealers until last week. A second fire killed Angela Dawson and five of her children, ages 8 to 14. Police arrested a man, reportedly a drug dealer, who lived nearby. The terrorist attacks of September the 11th, last week's bombing in Indonesia, the attacks on the U.S. Marines in Kuwait, fears of possible war in Iraq, North Korea's nuclear weapons program, and the sniper murders around Washington have all added to our sense that life is both fragile and precious. People who live in high-crime, impoverished neighborhoods experience those same anxieties and another set of fears. They worry about things many of us can't even conceive of. Will my child catch a stray bullet on the way to school? Is it safe to walk to the corner store after dark? What will happen if I stand up to the criminals? Can I trust the police? What can citizens, neighbors, and communities around the country do to fight crime? We want to hear what's happening in your town and your neighborhood, especially if it seems to be working. Do you belong to a neighborhood safety commission or a crime watchers group? Have you ever organized a crime-fighting program? And have you ever moved out of a neighborhood because of fears for your safety? If you're a police officer, we'd also like to hear from you. Do community programs like those really help? And what can police do to stop more crime in the most violent neighborhoods? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Shortly, we'll hear about a program that's working in Harlem, as well as a new crime-fighting program being launched next month in Peoria, Illinois. But first, we go to Baltimore. M. Dion Thompson is a reporter from the Baltimore Sun who's been covering the tragic events in his city. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
How are you doing, Neil?
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about Angela Dawson and what she was doing.
Well, she was referred to as a very caring and loving mother. She had moved into this neighborhood about 4 years ago and was known to walk her children back and forth to school. During the afternoon, she would be seen playing basketball with them in their little concrete backyard. So she was known up and down the block by most folks as a lady that was very friendly, very open, very caring and loving with her kids, but also known as a lady who had no problems calling the police on the various drug dealers and people who would be loitering around her house.
In some of the stories about her that I've read, some in the neighborhood were quoted as saying that they thought maybe she was, you know, a little excessive.
Well, yes, there were some people who thought that she just kept up. You know, it wouldn't matter if you were standing out in front of the house, if you were playing music that she thought was too loud, but some of the others did not think was too loud. And she apparently called the police about 36 times between June of this month, of this year, rather, and October. So she was always calling, and indeed, some people there thought that she was a nuisance. A lot of those people didn't really want to have their names attached to it and sort of felt odd and wondering whether or not, and to some degree, she might have brought this on herself.
What about the man who's been arrested? He has a long criminal record, I understand?
Fairly much. I mean, he's only 21 years old, so as far as we know right now, his record starts around 1998 with some assault and robbery charges. And between then and now, he was in and out of jail several times for assault, for malicious destruction, some narcotics charges, use of a deadly weapon, these sorts of things. And so he was a regular, person in terms of the criminal justice system. And he lived right around the corner from her.
And as I understand it, if the system had been working, in fact, he'd been on parole violations and he should probably have been in jail.
This is one of the most disconcerting things that has come up just recently is that he was supposed to report to his probation agent. He had been in jail throughout the summer and was released last month, and at that point he was supposed to be reporting, but he never reported to his probation officer, and so therefore the probation system never had any record of his whereabouts, and so he was allowed to just go free. And conceivably, he should have been in jail, but it's one of these, I guess, failings of the system when you're asking criminals to go down the street to their probation agent and report in. And oftentimes they don't.
And oftentimes they don't. And it seems ridiculous that you can avoid the whole system by simply not reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, the police are being criticized as well for not doing enough to protect Angela Dawson. What are they being called to task for, and what has been the police department's response?
Well, basically, it's the sense of whether or not, after the first firebombing, which occurred on October the 3rd, keep in mind then that the second bombing occurred on the 17th, but between that time, as to whether or not the police should have been at her house on a 24-hour basis, if they should have moved her or not. Those are two of the main concerns, particularly in terms of how much supervision or protection she should have been offered. Their response has been that she was offered a witness protection of some sort, and the family did not want that. Also that they were recommended that perhaps they should move, or suggested that they should move. They did not want to move. There was a very strong sense on the family's part that they did not feel that they should be driven out of their homes and out of their neighborhood by these drug dealers. And there's also a question as to whether or not they had the financial whereabouts to actually pick up and move to another house.
Yeah. What about her neighbors, though? Was she the only one trying to stop the drug dealers?
Apparently so. Apparently she's the only one who was making these regular calls. I mean, there were a lot of people sitting on the sidelines, you know, some cheering her on, some criticizing her, and I think that's one of the things that has really shaken people around the neighborhood and throughout the city, is the price that people pay for their silence. And there's, I think, a strong sense that had that neighborhood stood up, had the people on her block stood with her against the drug dealers and against what was happening, then she would not have been singled out for this attack.
I guess there's plenty enough blame to go around to everybody.
Definitely. There's a lot of soul-searching and hand-wringing going on right now.
Are people, do you think, in this area of Baltimore, and I guess throughout the city, do you think they're going to be emboldened? Do you think that they're going to call and report drug sales and drug deals and that sort of thing, maybe even reporting on some of their friends and families, or are they going to be frightened, subdued?
Well, you know, it's one of these time-will-tell sorts of situations right now. I mean, there is a huge sort of emotional surge and outcry right now for everyone to stand up, you know, to make those calls, to turn in your neighbor, to turn in your friends, your relatives, to do all that. But at the same time, all one has to do is drive by this house in East Baltimore and see where the fire burned through all the windows and through the door and see it boarded up and just see in a very real sense what the price is to pay. But I think hopefully there is a sense that if everyone sort of stands up, then maybe again people cannot be singled out for that attack.
I understand there's a, you know, sort of a memorial out there.
There is. You often have these things here in the city, and I'm sure elsewhere, when some tragedy like this happens, even if it's just a regular shooting, that people will bring either teddy bears or balloons or this sort of thing. But here at this house, particularly, I think, because of the number of children involved, there now is a shrine in which there are, I would say, perhaps 100 teddy bears, if not more, that have been dropped, and balloons, and there's been a gentleman who has been there for 4 or 5 days now who is collecting money for the family, and he reports that he has deposited $6,600 into an account for the family, just from people driving up, dropping dollars, $5, $10 into this jug.
The phrase you just used, just a regular shooting, we down here in Washington are familiar with phrases like that of late, and I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's just sort of, the unfortunate circumstance here, you know, when you're living in the big cities where you have so much drug violence that sometimes there are, you know, people who get killed, and you say, well, it's just a shooting, and then you have incidents like these that really, I think, shake a community to its core.
Thanks very much for speaking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
M. Dion Thompson is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, and he was with us from his office. And joining us now from our studios in New York is Jeffrey Canada, president of Harlem's Children's Zone, a community outreach program that covers a 24-block area. He's also the author of a book called Stick, Fist, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence in America. And Jeffrey Canada, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. I'm happy to be here.
Angela Dawson was doing exactly what we're all encouraged to do, to get involved, to call the police, not to hide inside your house. What does this tragedy say to people now?
You know, this is one of the most disturbing incidents, I think, that I've heard in the last couple of years. The person who bombed that house and killed that mother and those children were not just simply trying to send a message to her, but to send a message to the whole community that you are helpless, that you are powerless, that we control this and there's nothing you can do. And the same way we killed this family, we'll kill you. It is an evil and an heinous act. And I think that as a community, the folks in that community are going to have to come together and simply say, no, we will not be terrorized in the silence which destroys our lives and destroys our children. We're going to fight back.
We're going to hear more about the Harlem Children's Zone Project in a moment, but we want to get some callers involved. Our telephone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And our first caller is Rebecca, who's on the line with us from Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco.
Hi. I have a more, I guess, positive community story to talk about dealing with drugs. Since I do live in the Haight-Ashbury, there are drugs dealt here, and probably always will be because of its reputation. However, for the most part, I've been here for 17 years, and it's been mostly soft drugs or kind of undercover kind of dealing. Mm-hmm. But about seven or eight years ago, crack dealers started coming into our neighborhood from other neighborhoods to sell to people who come into our neighborhood from other neighborhoods to buy the drugs. And there was more violence involved when the crack dealers came in. There was a lot more crime going on in the neighborhood. And at the time, I and a lot of my neighbors had very small children on our block, and we live a block away from Haight and Ashbury. And so the community kind of came together and decided that we didn't want this in our neighborhood. And as we would sit outside on our stoops and watch our children play, if we saw the dealers coming around the corner to deal drugs on our block, we yelled at the buyers. We didn't yell at the dealers because that wasn't going to do any good, but we did yell at the buyers, and it scared a lot of people off, and eventually the crack dealing moved out of our neighborhood. We weren't the only people doing it. There were some other community groups that got together and actually went out at night and patrolled the streets and would yell at buyers at night in a group with walkie-talkies, and they were, you know, would talk to the police. And that helped, too. So it was a case of the community coming together and actually doing something about a violent situation that was starting to happen in our neighborhood.
Jeffrey Canada, that is a much brighter story.
And, you know, stories like that are happening all over America where community groups are getting involved. You know, for drug dealing to flourish, it really needs a certain kind of darkness. It needs people to believe that there's nothing they can do, that they can't get involved. Once you get citizens on the streets, you'll find that people who buy drugs don't want to buy drugs in front of their neighbors. They don't want people to see what they're doing. So just the act of getting the community involved often has a real impact on how drugs are sold. Of course, there is a counter to that the drug dealers know, which is that you have to intimidate folks in order to stop that from happening. And often they will try and figure out who is the sort of prime instigator. And if we can find that person and terrorize them, then we can quiet and silence the whole community, which is why I think in situations like the one that Angela faced, that it's imperative that we get others involved, and it's not just one individual doing this crusading against drugs.
Well, Rebecca, congratulations.
Thank you, and I agree exactly what he said. If the community hadn't come together as a whole, we could not have done what we did.
We're talking about what communities can do to fight crime. Are you part of a neighborhood watch group? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send email to us, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about different ways people around the country are trying to fight crime in their neighborhoods. We want to hear what's happening in your community. If you're in law enforcement, tell us what it's like on your city streets. If you're part of the Neighborhood Watch Group, we'd like to hear how it's working. Our number, 800-989-8255, or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. Our guest is Jeffrey Canada, who's president of the Harlem Children's Zone. And Jeffrey Canada, what is that? What's the Harlem Children's Zone?
Well, you know, we started something we call the Harlem Children's Zone Project for exactly the reasons that I think Angela Dawson was trying to make a difference in her community in Baltimore. There are some communities in this country where the civic infrastructure has been so torn apart that nothing seems to be going right. There does not seem to be an organized response to any of the kinds of pressures and issues that lots of people face in urban America. And one of the things we decided to do was to rebuild community. And we tried to figure out what was the right size for us. And it was a 24-block area in Central Harlem. And we said in order to really rebuild that community, we had to think about the different levels of leadership that needed to exist for that community to become a better place for children. And so we started organizing tenant associations in tenant buildings. We organized block associations because these institutions actually have as their main function making sure that the individual buildings are run and the issues are dealt with, that there's a leadership group, the same for the block. Then we began to connect these groups with one another so that individuals weren't feeling like they were isolated and cut off. And you found that the same issue you were dealing with on 116th Street, they were dealing with it on 119th Street, they were dealing with it on 123rd Street. And those groups became a one-knit group, and we began to talk about their issues collectively. It's no surprise that when you begin to bring leaders together and then provide real training for them, so that, you know, community organizing is a skill. We send our people away to school to learn how to organize better in their own communities. We developed a very strong group called the Community Advisory Board, which has really played a major role in making sure that the issues of drugs and crime are dealt with. They have a wonderful relationship with their police department. They go as a body, not as individuals. They talk openly about the issues because it's not just one person talking, it is the community talking. And we've seen a real impact in Harlem from that kind of work.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Angela, who's with us from Detroit.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. I'm so grateful for the discussion that you're having. There was a comment or a suggestion about people who have chosen to leave their communities.
Mm-hmm.
And in March of this past year, my cousin was murdered. And I'm a community planner in Detroit. And that's where my education and my work had primarily been for the last 11 years. And just this past year after that, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for me. So I relocated to East Lansing, but I'm choosing to continue my studies and get my doctorate and look at evaluating from a holistic perspective these types of programs. How are the universities or other resources working together in collaboration to help communities like in Detroit, which is a very large city, with a lot of programs happening, but they all don't communicate with each other effectively? How do we start addressing this program or addressing this issue from not just neighborhood-level perspectives, but bureaucratic perspectives? And after working as a planner, the bureaucracy was extremely overwhelming. So I'm choosing to do kind of more as one person making a difference, more of a collective opportunity, not just in Detroit, but nationally.
Angela, if I could ask, was your cousin killed in and obviously we're sorry for your loss, but was it a drug situation?
It was not specifically a drug situation, no.
But
he had been a former drug dealer a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey Canada, you know, obviously it's hard to question anybody's judgment about, you know, when is too much and when they leave. But a lot of your program and a lot of what you talk about is staying.
Yeah, you know, we think that the real essence of rebuilding community is convincing young people that to make it means not that you pick up and you leave the community, but that you come and you contribute back to a rebuilding of the community. The critical piece of our work is to engage our young college-age young people, our teens, and our preteens in community-building work. We think that we have to give young people real leadership skills and the tools necessary to tackle problems and defeat those problems so that they grow up thinking, I'm making a change in my community right now, and won't this be a much better community when years go by and I get more education and I can come in and do more work? Mm-hmm. We find that young people, when they're engaged in helping, they're out planting gardens, they're out removing graffiti, they're out cleaning up parks. We find that when young people do that, they begin to feel really good about their community, and they begin to talk about, I want to get a college education so I can come back and make even more of a difference, versus how it was before we started, when young people said, look, I hope I can get a college education so I can get out of here so that maybe me and my family can survive. So we think that the young people as a leadership group is absolutely critical if we're going to make sure that communities get rebuilt and stay rebuilt for a period of time.
Angela, I just wanted to make sure you understood none of that was in any way intended as a personal judgment about what you decided you had to do. And, you know, obviously that decision is entirely up to you. So anyway, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Okay. Now let's go to Ted. And Ted joins us on the line from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, sir. How you doing? Great to hear you.
Thank you.
So I'm a police officer. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm actually out in Jefferson County, and I've been in law enforcement 14 years. And crack, as it really kind of started off in the Middle East, when it really started to take effect and form and getting slung on the street corners and stuff, it's come to a point where it's strangling us. It's just absolutely eating us alive. And, you know, sadly enough, you would be surprised what your next-door neighbor may be doing, whether it's crack or meth or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I learned a long time ago in criminal justice classes by a professor, God rest his soul, Gary Brazen, in California. He said that the police are actually failing when they are playing reaction, when they're trying to catch the criminal after he's done the act, because our first line job is prevention, and we have fallen so short of that. I mean, we try all kinds of new programs to revamp the system, community-oriented policing, school resource officers. But, we're just never going to have enough means available to do what we really actually need to do. And we just fall so short of it, unfortunately.
A lot of the issue, though, also seems to involve the question of trust in the neighborhoods and in the community, that a lot of people just don't trust the police.
Well, I know that. I know that for a fact, because I've been there, done that. And I remember growing up, I used to be scared of them because, they put your hands on you in the good old days, as they say. Everybody talks about the good old days. But I've done a lot of work with youth groups, and African-American kids, and it's, believe me, it's an us versus them when you're talking about a white male talking to a black kid. It's about 13, 14. And but it's strange. How do I say this with a... it's from, I'll say, the heck with the police, so to speak, keeping it clean. But 30 days later, after a few of these explorer classes or youth classes or whatever, they want to be the police. They see things in a different light. There's just that big rift between the two. We have to break down as a barrier, but police officers often get so cynical about wanting to even have communication. That ain't my job, I'm not a social worker, and stuff like that, And when you start feeling a little differently and thinking, if I talk to these kids, it'll be a little different. And it's like I tell kids, when you see a cop, wave at him. Use all your fingers, wave at him with your hand, And I said, you'll get a reaction. I said, he'll probably wave back, nod back at you. I said, and if it's the same corner, same place you're always at, bus stop, hopefully you're not just hanging on that corner, or wherever you're at, I said, he'll get to know you, he'll get to see you. I said, once in a while, ask him what he does for a living, how long he's been a police officer, what exactly his job is, So you can ask all the same questions everybody does. You ever shot anybody? They always ask that. I said, but they'll get to know you. I said, you'll have a different view of this guy. He's actually a person behind that car. But, it's just such a divide. Unfortunately, our premise, our outlook and everything has been so discontented with the negatives we have. The police officers that got caught doing this, that, or the other thing have just absolutely put us in the black. We're the, almost the enemy again.
Yeah.
The problem being, it's like, good old Mark Farman, that name, the only logical thing, I guess, he was actually an intelligent person with just a very stupid side, I think.
Yeah.
And he made one good comment. I seen him on an interview once. He said, here you are, you're a police officer, that lives over in this side of town, but yet you police on this side. You don't go to your kids don't go to their schools. You don't shop there. You don't eat there. You don't hang out there. You're not going to entertainment there. You don't have family and friends, but you police them. How do they look at you then? And you're never invited to dinner. You're always coming for something bad. And we've gone to community-oriented policing where we do walking beats and stuff like that, and all that helps. it's just like I say, I am so positive on the youth groups. We need to do more with that because, you know, it's cynical or liberal or whatever you want to say it sounds, it's our future. It really, truly is our future. I mean, the kids are the ones that are going to grow up. You know, they're going to be the ones that make the decision, whether I'm going to go sling this rock and make $1,000 a week or I'm going to go work at McDonald's and, you know, bring $142 before taxes, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Ted, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we appreciate the phone call.
Appreciate you.
Now let's be joined by Clyde Gully. He's in Peoria, Illinois, where he's a city councilman in the 1st District there. And thanks very much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're starting a new program in Peoria. It's called Neighbors Count. How is that going to work?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's going to deal with some of the issues that we just talked about from the police officer and from Angela, where we saw that there was a need to get people involved. Can't solve all the problems with 1,000 police officers, but if we had 130,000 people in the city that was working to fight crime, then that would make a difference. And the way it's going to work is basically is we're going to work toward changing attitude because we see the attitude of the people is one of the problems that we're really dealing with. And if we could change the attitude of the people and cause them to be more involved in fighting crime, fighting litter, fighting all the things that ail the stabilization of our neighborhoods, then it would make a difference.
What sparked this? I mean, most of us don't think of Peoria as a place with a high crime rate.
Well, and there's and I'm glad you mentioned it that way. It's not a high crime rate, but any crime is too much crime.
Well,
if there was one shooting, that's too many. If there was one robbery, that's too many. So I think the way we look at it is that in certain pockets in Peoria, just like in other cities, there are things that are going on that we wish weren't happening in our city. So we could accept it or we could do something to fight back against it. And our philosophy is the way to fight back is to create a new initiative to come together as a community and stand against it. And that initiative now is called Neighbors Count.
Jeffrey Canada, I wanted to bring you back into this. What's the relationship of your project with the police, and what do you make of what Mr. Gully's doing?
First of all, I think what Mr. Gully's doing is exactly the right thing. We have a really terrific relationship with the police, but that's partially due to the fact that we really reached out to our local police officers. We have community policing. We have police who have been trained to work with the community, and we have really connected the police officers to the community on a regular basis. And this is part of the problem. People, when there's a crime or some horrible situation, they want to reach out to the police, but people don't get to know police officers as human beings who care about their safety and who care about the issues and people who you trust. If there is not trust there, the community is not going to work with the police. But I also think that focusing on police or around crime exclusively is a mistake. One of the things that people don't recognize in New York City, we've had this wonderful reduction in crime that's been going on now for quite a few years. But it all began when we placed what we call beacon schools, which were community centers where you take a public school, you keep it open till 10, 11 o'clock at night, you keep it open 7 days a week, you do it year round. We placed those in the highest crime areas in New York City, specifically because the captain of the police force said, if our young people don't have any place to go and anything to do, there is nothing we can do as a police force to reduce the crime. That if young people have no options except hanging on street corners, you know, I tell people I've never yet seen young people reading Shakespeare on a street corner. I mean, it might happen somewhere, but it's not likely to happen. Young people tend to get into the rhythms of the street when they're on the corners, and the older they get, the worse it gets. So we think you've got to open up places, you've got to open up schools, you've got to get these young people off the streets, connected to caring adults, not just for 3 to 6, but for the later hours when the teenagers are out and they need a place to go, and coupled with the policing strategy, I think that that's what's really going to drive results in terms of reduction in crime.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Clyde Gully, I just wanted to follow up and ask, you know, Jeffrey Canada was saying about, you know, kids hanging around on street corners. I suspect they do that in Peoria, too. Do you run into them? Do you talk to them? Do you find out what they're doing?
Absolutely. And, you know, and I agree with what he's saying about keeping the schools open. You know, it's very interesting that we do some of the same things in Peoria that they're doing on the East Coast. We have our schools open. We have a 21st century learning centers in four of the schools that are in our areas of concern. We have midnight basketball. We have everything from sewing programs to gardening programs, and the list goes on. So we're doing some of those same things, and we see kids that's out here on the street, and a lot of times we make sure that we communicate with them so we understand some of the concerns that they have, understand why they are out there on the corner, why are they involved in the drug program, why are they not involved in some of these other programs that we're establishing around the city. So we try to make sure we take an active role in making sure not only do we recognize that they're there, but we try to create a line of communication so we can draw them into some of the programs that are going to help us to change the very fiber of our neighborhood.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us today, and good luck.
Thank you very much, and thanks to Jeffrey and what they're doing. We appreciate all what's going on the East Coast as well.
Clyde Gully is city councilman for the 1st District of Peoria, and he was with us from his office in Peoria. Now our next caller is Bill, who's on the line with us from Chicago. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I just want to talk about in Chicago, we've got a community policing program, and in my neighborhood, we had drug dealing going on. People who had moved in were dealing to people who were driving into the neighborhood, and we got together with some of the people in the community, talked to the police, got the word out to other people in the community that they could call 911 and be anonymous, which was kind of a good thing because people were scared, and eventually... through the police working on the landlord, we were able to go to court with some of the citizens and a police officer. The judge saw that there was some interest in the case, and immediately there was some action. The people finally did move out, and the neighborhood got quiet almost overnight.
Jeffrey Canada, we just have a minute left in this part of the program, but persistence is a big part of it, isn't it?
You know, that's why it was so evil what happened in Baltimore, because when communities continue to fight, after a while, the institutions, the police, the political institutions, they begin to care and they begin to say, well, you know what? If you don't do anything else, take care of that neighborhood, because those people will be here knocking on my door demanding justice for their community. And that's what we've got to get community groups to realize. They can't give up. They have to, even if they've suffered, even if someone's gotten killed, you have to go back, reorganize, tackle this issue, not give up to these drug dealers.
Well, Bill, thanks very much for the call. Jeffrey Canada, thanks so much for being with us today.
Really my pleasure, Bill.
Jeffrey Canada is president of the Harlem Children's Zone. His most recent book is called Reaching Up for Manhood, Transforming the Lives of Boys in America. And he was with us from our bureau in New York.